we're delighted this morning to have Dr. Kerry McGonigal speaking in our chapel. Dr. McGonigal is one of our Bible teachers, and I know he's beloved by many students for his classes. He also is the pastor of the Beth Haven Baptist Church in Simpsonville, South Carolina, and he and his wife and their three lovely children are here today in chapel. And so I hope your heart will be open as he continues on in our series, What is Man? I hope that you're listening carefully. Each message is unique, helping us understand the nature and the way God's created us and how it is that we live for his glory. Dr. McGonigal.
Well, good morning, everyone. I've been asked to address a couple of related questions today. The first one is, how bad can a good man be? How bad can a good man be? And how far has man fallen? Now, I'm going to be honest and say that I struggled a little bit with that first question, how bad can a good man be, initially, to the point where I was thinking maybe we should just have a singspiration today. You know, we could take our favorite hymns about human depravity or years I spent in vanity or in pride. That's a cheery one. But when you're given a question like this, obviously, one of the first things that I did in my mind was ask the question, does the Bible actually address this question? And where can we go in 25, 30 minutes to actually satisfactorily answer the question, how bad can a good man be? Well, you know, in some cases, you have to go to multiple passages. But I think what we can do today is go to Romans chapter 1, verse 18, through Romans chapter 3, verse 20. And in that first section of Paul's letter to the Romans, we can answer this question satisfactorily. So turn to Romans chapter 3 this morning. Again, the question is, how bad can a good man be? So what I had to do was kind of rephrase that in my own mind so I understood the question. Are non-Christians capable of doing good? And if so, then are good people really that bad? Are non-Christians capable of doing good? And then, if so, then are good people really that bad? And so I'm going to begin with a dilemma and see if you can identify with this dilemma. Have you ever been confused or shaken, perhaps, by the goodness of bad people? Let me explain. In our minds, we tend to identify non-Christians as sinners. And of course, we understand that being a sinner is something bad, and we even use words like corrupt and depraved and fallen to describe those people. So I think, you know, what tends to come in our mind, we think of sinner and corrupt and depraved are those orcs on the Lord of the Rings movies, right? Those beautiful creatures. They're ugly, they're despicable, they're hateful, they seek to do harm. There's nothing beautiful about the orcs, and so, you know, that's kind of what it means to be depraved and fallen and corrupted in sin. And maybe it is that you grew up in a very controlled environment, and so you really didn't get to leave the confines of your Christian home very much or your Christian school, and so for you it was kind of like the zoo animals on Madagascar, you know, Marty the lion and or Marty the zebra and Alex the lion, and you know, they venture outside the New York City Zoo for the first time. And so perhaps when you did that, you faced a conflicting reality. Because on the one hand, you found people that would eat you alive. You did find people that were hateful and hurtful and despicable and ugly. But then there was this other group of people that you encountered that was confusing. I mean, what about the many non-Christians who aren't like that? They're kind, they're generous, they're servant-hearted, they're hardworking. I mean, don't these people kind of shatter our stereotypes and our conception of what it means to be a sinner? Don't they call into question words like corrupt and fallen? And so my intent in this message isn't to focus on the Hitlers and the Stalins of the human race. My intent is not to draw our attention to examples from ISIS to point out the depravity of man. I think the evil is apparent in those cases, and we have a category for that. But what about all the good people in the world who are not Christians? And yet they love and they care and they help and they serve and they work hard. So let me just give you a couple of examples. We have some folks in our church that are associated with the and from the island of Dominica. And recently the island was devastated by Tropical Storm Erica. And in the aftermath of that, you had two kinds of people. You did have what we typically think of as the corruption and the depravity when you see people looting homes and stores and showing the just unimaginable corruption of the human heart to actually take advantage of other people in a situation like that. But then on the other hand, you have non-Christian people who are involved in rescue efforts, who are risking life and limb to help other human beings. And so I'm asking the question, are these non-Christian rescuers really that bad? I recently read a book by Rosaria Butterfield entitled The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. And Rosaria is a former tenured professor of English at Syracuse University. And prior to her conversion to Christianity in 1999, she was in a lesbian relationship with a woman who was an animal activist and nature lover. And Rosaria writes in her book, "My partner, T, ran a business. She rehabilitated abused and abandoned golden retrievers for placement as helper dogs for the disabled or family dogs for those animals not strong enough to work." She says, "Our houses were hubs of intellectual and activist work. Aside from the kennel, we supported a lot of causes, AIDS health care, children's literacy, sexual abuse healing, and disability activism." And I'm thinking, what's wrong with that? Those are all good things, right? And in her book, she describes the gay and lesbian community as a community given to hospitality. Given to hospitality. At one point, she writes, "Here's one of the deepest ways Christians scared me. The lesbian community was home and felt safe and secure. The people that I knew the best and cared about were in that community. The lesbian community was accepting and welcoming, while the Christian community appeared and too often is exclusive, judgmental, scornful, and afraid of diversity." So what do you do with that? I mean, are these people fallen or not? Have you ever been shaken? Have you ever been confused by the goodness of bad people? Coupled with that, you have the badness of good people, and I'm referring there to professing Christians. Well, you say, of course they're fallen. Of course they're corrupt. I mean, their very lifestyle is in violation of God's express will. Okay, but what do you do with people whose lives are generally in agreement with the morality spelled out in the Bible? I mean, they're upstanding, they're ethical, they're honest, they're reliable, they're good parents, they're community servants. I mean, are you telling me that that non-Christian firefighter who risks his life and runs into a burning building to rescue another human being is corrupt? Is fallen? I mean, even Jesus acknowledges in Luke chapter 6, verses 32 and 33, that sinners can love and sinners can do good. He says, "For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye? For sinners also love those that love them. And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same." Now, sure, they're loving those who love them, but they are loving, not hating. Yes, they're doing good to those who do good to them, but they are doing good, right? So we're left asking this question, are all non-Christians really that bad? How bad can a good man be, or how good can a bad man be? Well, to answer these questions, we obviously need God's perspective, don't we? So I had you turn to Romans chapter 3, and it's in this passage that Paul is bringing an accusation against all people, both Jew and Gentile. So what's the specific charge? Look at the end of verse 9. His accusation is this: all are under sin. That is, all people universally are under the power of sin. Which reminds us, doesn't it, that our problem as human beings isn't just that we commit specific sins, specific acts of sin, but that we by birth actually dwell and reside in a realm, a government, ruled over by sin and death and the law. And the deeds that we commit, the sinful thoughts, the sinful words, the sinful behaviors are simply expressions of the fact that we're under that government, under that rule of sin, under the power of sin. So when he says all, he's referring to all people universally, whether you're Jew or non-Jew. And this is something that Paul has been arguing for, beginning in chapter 1, verse 18, running through chapter 2, verse 29. And that's what he means when he says, "For we have before proved, both Jew and Gentiles, that all are under sin." And so now what follows in verses 10 through 18 of chapter 3 is a series of quotations from the Old Testament that are designed to further substantiate that assertion, that charge, that everyone universally is under the power of sin. So let's go ahead and read verses 10 through 12. Paul writes, "As it is written," and at this point he's quoting from Psalm 14, "There is none righteous, no, not one." And then he gives these five synonymous repetitions of the theme, "There is none righteous." He says, verse 11, "There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. No, not one." So sin is clearly universal. And Paul seems to be saying at this point that there's not a single person who does good. And now what he does in verses 13 to 17 is he gives us further quotations from the Old Testament and gives us representative or example kinds of sins to, again, support the idea that all of us are under sin. And he gives sins of speech and sins of violence in particular. So look at verse 13. He says, "Their throat is an open sepulcher or grave. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace have they not known." So you've got their throat and their tongues and their lips and their mouth and their feet all giving expression of being under the power of sin. That's the extent of sin's reign. And then the final quotation in verse 18 is taken from Psalm 36, verse 1, and it functions to bring this series of examples to a conclusion. And here's what Paul says, "There is no fear of God before their eyes." That really is at the heart of the matter. That really is the fundamental problem that lies behind all of these specific expressions. There's no fear of God before their eyes. They don't live in the acknowledgement that God is God. And that's the problem. So where does that leave us? Verse 19. Now, Paul is going to draw out some of the implications of being under sin. "We know that whatsoever things the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty or accountable before God." And if there's any Jew there that says, "Well, how can that be? I mean, what about my observance of the law?" Verse 20, "Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin." So here we are, all of us together. We're standing in a courtroom, as it were. We're standing before God, the great judge of the universe, and all of us are being pronounced guilty because of sin. We face the sentence of eternal condemnation. So let me just draw a couple of conclusions from this passage. It's really clear, isn't it, that from God's perspective, in spite of any appearances to the contrary, that there's not a single one of us in the human race who does good. And it's clear from the context of Romans that there's not a single person that can stand before God and justify himself or herself on the basis of his goodness, on the basis of his or her own righteousness. No one is good enough. And that would include all of those non-Christians whose lives cause us to question fallenness and depravity. And based on chapter 1, verse 18, Not only are we under the power of sin, Paul says that we are under the wrath of God. The righteous wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness. And that's a problem because we're all unrighteous. Okay, so you're saying that some of the nicest people that I know in this world are enslaved to sin. They are unrighteous. And you're saying that they're going to endure the wrath of God. You know, my non-Christian elderly neighbor doesn't have a mouth full of cursing and bitterness. And she's not out there. Her feet are not swift to shed blood. It's kind of difficult to accept, isn't it? Unless, and here's really the critical heart of this message, unless we understand sin and unrighteousness from God's perspective. In other words, I think much of our confusion, much of the reason that we struggle with this is because we fail to understand really what sin is, what it means for man to be fallen. And that's where Romans chapter 1 comes in, and I'd ask you to turn there, Romans chapter 1. Because I think most of us tend to externalize, or we could say we tend to behavioralize sin. And we also tend to minimize sin. So we stay on the surface. And because we stay on the surface, we make surface comparisons with people. And that's why we struggle. And what this passage does is it internalizes the problem. It brings it right to the core, right to the heart of who we are. And it magnifies the seriousness and the gravity and the import of sinfulness. So you can't read Romans 1 and then kind of come away thinking that sin is like a parking ticket. You know, I know I violated the law, and there's a sense in which I deserve this parking ticket, but, you know, it's not really a big deal. I mean, there are real criminals out there. You know, why don't they spend their time getting those guys? Sin, according to Romans 1, is this, and I'm taking the liberty to summarize just because of time, but I've gone through this passage and kind of put the details together, and really I think you could argue that sin, based on Romans 1, is any treasonous attempt to overthrow the good and righteous government of God or our Creator in thought, in word, or in deed. And that all is rooted in a refusal to acknowledge God as God. And it leads to further increasing moral darkness, and it's completely deserving of the righteous wrath of God. So sin is any treasonous attempt to overthrow the good and righteous government of our Creator in word, thought, or deed. And I think that substantiates what we've seen in Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve fell, right? I mean, there's a sense in which you look at that passage, you're thinking, you know, wow, good grief. I mean, they just disobeyed one command. They took some fruit. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that that command, that prohibition, wasn't just an arbitrary one. It wasn't just an impersonal command that they broke. What they were doing when they transgressed was they were declaring independence from the authority and the government of God. It was a declaration of independence. They had believed the lie of Satan, that ye shall be as gods. So the prohibition, that tree that was in the middle of the garden, stood as a reminder that Adam and Eve were underneath an authority, underneath the sovereignty of their Creator. For them to disobey and transgress was to throw off that government, that restraint. Now look with me at Romans chapter 1. Let's go ahead and read verses 18 to 25, and we'll see how Paul really describes sin and its essence. He says, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. So it's kind of like when you get in the swimming pool and you've got one of those inflatable balls and you try to keep it under the water. That's what mankind does with the truth that is made known about God. They try to suppress it and keep it under so they don't have to deal with the implications and the consequences of that revelation. Because, verse 19, that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed or exchanged the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. So therefore God gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who exchanged the truth of God into a lie. And what was that lie? They worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. So we find in Romans 1 that at the heart of our sinful thoughts, at the heart of our sinful words, at the heart of our sinful deeds is this refusal to acknowledge God, as Creator God. And that's exactly what Paul said in chapter 3, verse 18. When he came to the list, the conclusion of that series of examples of sins, he said there was no fear of God in their eyes, before their eyes. What is the opposite of the fear of God? I mean, the fear of God is living with a God consciousness, a God awareness. The opposite of the fear of the Lord in the Old Testament, in the poetic books, is contempt for the Lord. What is contempt for God? Well, you can show contempt for people in different ways, can't you? Contempt for another person. I mean, if you want to show contempt to somebody walking across the bridge after chapel, you can, you know, give them this, do a few other things to them. That would be contempt. But it's also possible to display contempt for somebody. In fact, perhaps the most powerful way to do this is to actually ignore them, to just walk right by them and pretend as if they didn't even exist. That is contempt. Mankind, Paul is arguing, lives his life as if God is not God, as if God doesn't exist, even though they know that he does. And they refuse to live and operate under that authority, under that government. And right at the heart of this is this exchange that takes place when mankind chooses to worship the creature above the Creator, to displace God from his rightful position. And so someone has written, if the greatest commandment is to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, body, strength, then the greatest sin is not to do that. The greatest sin is not to love God with all of our heart, with all of our being. And so we're not content just to look at superficial considerations. We want to go beyond the surface of what we're seeing and go to the heart of the matter. What's driving us? What's at the core of who we are as human beings? So we start understanding, once we start understanding what sin is, we start getting down to the core of who we are, and we start dealing with what drives us as human beings. You know, it's easy for us to see fallenness on the surface of drug addicts and swindlers and fornicators. But with a biblical understanding of sin, we can begin to understand how a non-Christian could do good in one sense and yet not be doing good in another sense. So a non-Christian firefighter who enters a building ablaze to save lives is doing something good. He's risking his life for the good of another person. Or let's take your non-Christian neighbor who gladly, for whatever reason, gladly volunteers to mow your grass while you guys are on vacation. That person is doing something good, something altruistic. Now, we could try to examine, okay, yeah, but if you really look at their motivations, they're motivated by self-fulfillment, they're motivated by self-glory. Okay, that's certainly possible. But the question remains, the fundamental question remains, are they acknowledging God as God in those acts? Do they recognize or acknowledge that that desire to help, that desire to do good is a gift from God? All good gifts come down from the Father of lights. Do they recognize what theologians sometimes call common grace, that what they have, whether it's their pleasant disposition, their agreeable temperament, is actually part of common grace? It's a gift from God. But do they acknowledge and recognize that? Do they realize that any goodness that is being displayed there is a reflection of the image of God in them? Yes, the image of God is marred, but it's not effaced. It's not eradicated. Do they understand that pulling somebody out of a burning house, as good as that may be, is never good enough to bring them to a point where they could stand before God and justify themselves? Do they understand that? Do they recognize that all of their righteousnesses are as filthy rags? Do they help and do they serve out of a desire to reflect God to others, out of a desire to glorify God, out of a desire to serve God and to do His will? Do they sacrifice themselves and live the way they do because they seek to do God's will? And they live in dependence on their Creator. Because if the answer to any one of those questions is no, then they are falling short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23. And as hard, I know, it's as hard as it may be or seem to understand, they are rebels. They are rebels committing treason against the government of God. They are suppressing the truth that they know about God. They are exchanging the truth of God for a lie. They're guilty of idolatry, of worshiping the creature more than the Creator, of worshiping some God replacement. Now, they may not be murdering people. They may not be unfaithful to their spouse. They may not be habitual liars. But they're not loving the one true and living God with all their heart either. And that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. And that's a huge problem. That's how far man has fallen. That's how bad a good man can be. So bad that he effectively displaces the God of the universe, the Creator of all things, by the way that he lives. So bad that he refuses to live under the authority of God. And that's why mankind needs the righteousness of God. And that's why mankind needs a heart transformation, a heart renovation. And that is found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's the next section of this epistle, Romans chapter 3, verse 21. But now the righteousness of God is revealed through faith in Jesus Christ. Is there any hope for fallen human beings? Yes, there is. It's in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And this gospel, if properly understood, brings us all the way to Romans chapter 11, verse 36, where Paul says, "For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever." That is what God created us for, to live that kind of life where we recognize that everything comes from God. He's the source of all. And we do everything through the power and the energy and the grace of God. And we do it all back to the glory of God, of Him and through Him and back to Him are all things. To Him be glory. That's our created design. That's why God made us. And our fallenness reflects how far we've gone from that design. Let me just say, Jesus didn't come to make good people better. He came to save sinners. And viewing sin in ways other than God does, or less than God does, only serves to diminish the greatness of God's power and the glory of His grace in the gospel. Let's magnify the glory of the gospel by holding and embracing a scriptural view of sin. Father, we pray that you would help us to understand things from your perspective, to share your viewpoint about human nature and the extent to which we have fallen. And Father, my intent in preaching this message was not for us to go out, pat ourselves on the back, and say, "Wow, I'm glad I'm not one of them." Lord, help us not to be deceived by the superficial, the surface. Help us not to be content with the superficial. Help us to go beyond external morality. We know that Christian change is not less than behavioral change, but it's so much more. that you intend through the gospel to so renovate, to so change us, to so overhaul us that our mind and our emotions and our will are really given to this ultimate task of bringing you glory as the Creator God. And so through the gospel and by your grace, Lord, do that work of regeneration and sanctification for the glory of your blessed name. Amen.